Welcome today to this month's Live Well Today webinar. I'm Chris Krueger from the Davis Finney Foundation's content team, and I'm really happy to be here with an excellent panel to discuss the ways that we can improve Parkinson's care and help folks get the care they need when they need it. So just a quick little summary here. With Parkinson's, there are just so many challenges with care access, and two of the most impactful can be that just the fact that Parkinson's can affect so many different parts of a person's life. And when you factor in the effects that these can have on the Parkinson's can have on the lives of friends and family, the range of impacts of Parkinson's can just be so much more substantial. And the second thing that is often a problem is that from neurologists who have a deep understanding of Parkinson's to gastroenterologists, neuropsychiatrists, neurotrained PTs, there just really aren't always enough people with Parkinson's expertise who can help provide care for those of us living with Parkinson's. And moreover, those experts aren't evenly distributed around the country or the world. So we want to try to help understand how to get access to the people that you can see to help you. Before we dive into this topic, I'd like to ask the folks on the panel to introduce themselves. And why don't we start with Milena Sumrall?
Hi, my name's Milena Sumrall. As he said, I was a care partner for my husband who had Parkinson's disease dementia. Had the Parkinson's for 15 years. And so I've been involved in lots of different ways now trying to support the palliative care model for working with Parkinson's.
All right, great. Thanks, Mona. And Adrian, why don't you give us a sense of where you're at and what your story is?
You bet. Hi, everybody. My name is Adrian Duby. I live in Anchorage, Alaska. I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease 5 years ago, actually, as of Monday. I had a cake and everything to celebrate. I'm fortunate in that I was able to start within 24 hours of my diagnosis at a rock steady boxing program here in Anchorage. And I have become a coach, and I've been coaching there for about 4 years now. I also was one of the first people in the video version because of COVID of the PD Self program, which is a program designed specifically for people within the first 3 years of their diagnosis. And I was able to complete that and then was asked to become a facilitator and have been a facilitator and hope to be a facilitator in the future. I'm active in my local support group that I help facilitate, and also in a number of different of the nonprofit organizations around the country.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Adrian. Two things have been mentioned that we'll talk about a little more as the course of this conversation goes on, I hope, which are PD Self and palliative care. Two things that are important to discuss. And yes, I share your hope, Adrian, that we can keep you involved in continuing to deliver PD Self resources. Jen, how about you go next, please?
Hi, I'm Jen Corcoran. I'm a movement disorders neurologist, actually practicing, though, in a neuropalliative care clinic at the University of Rochester in upstate New York. And I both see patients with Parkinson's and other movement disorders, and I also do research that's oriented or research at the intersection of palliative care and movement disorders and Parkinson's disease.
Great. Thanks. And Larry.
Hi, everybody. My name's Larry Linton, and I live in Canada. I'm representing Canada this morning, and it's actually my birthday today, and I haven't had a slice of cake yet. I have been practicing corporate immigration law for the past 30 years and recently launched my own coaching business to assist people with Parkinson's going through the disclosure dilemma, as I call it, accommodation requests and everything of the impact on a career with the disclosure. Happy to be here and look forward to contributing and learning. Thank you.
Well, happy birthday, Larry. I wish we had a way to make everybody sing or to invite everyone to sing you happy birthday, but I think that might be out of the realm of the Zoom capacity for this call. So we'll all have to sing it to you in our own private way, because I'm not doing it and I'm not asking the rest of the panelists to do it, because everybody would leave. Wendy, please give us a sense of where you're at and what your story is, please.
Hi, I'm Wendy Cernick, and I'm a semi-retired nurse. I've worked in various parts of nursing, but the most recent one was a movement disorders neurology in an outpatient clinic in Colorado. And we started a neuropalliative clinic there 12 years ago, 13 years ago. We did that for about 8 years. And then after that, I did semi-retire. I'm working in neuropalliative research right now, and I live in rural upstate Idaho. So I'm here for any rural questions that people might have on access to care.
All right. Well, as you can see, we have a group of folks on this call that have a wide range of experience of Parkinson's. And I should add, because it might become relevant, that I also live with Parkinson's. I was diagnosed in 2020, and I've probably had symptoms since 2014 or so. Okay, so let's get started. I'm going to ask Jen a question to start us off. I think a lot of the folks in the audience are going to be aware of the need for a care team. But to set the stage for the conversation, can you just say a little bit about why only having a PCP or a general neurologist may not be optimal for a person living with Parkinson's? And basically just why would we want to have a care team? What's the importance of that for us as we live with Parkinson's?
Yeah. So sort of like two things in there, sort of why a movement disorder specialist and also like why do you need a care team? And I think maybe I'll start with why a movement disorder specialist is nice to have, though not always accessible. I think, you know, I did a general neurology round of clinical training before doing a movement disorders fellowship. And you just like don't get nearly, I think most people are really not getting nearly the exposure that they need to management of or a treatment of people with Parkinson's disease. Just during general neurology training, you're seeing people with a lot of other different neurological issues as well. You may not, just because of the length of training, really ever get to see someone through the different phases of the disease, and might not be the most comfortable with some of the medication options out there, non-medication approaches to symptoms. It may also not be the most comfortable identifying someone who might be eligible for an advanced therapy like deep brain stimulation, right? There's usually a window where people may be a candidate, and that window can close. And if we miss the window, we missed it. And then primary care providers don't, you know, by definition, aren't getting neurology training at all. They do, you know, different specialties to become a primary care provider, and they really might not have a lot of experience treating Parkinson's disease. So I worry about symptoms not being adequately addressed, symptoms being misidentified, or people not getting the best options for their care. As to why you need a team, Parkinson's, like you alluded to in the intro, affects a lot of different parts of the body, even though it's a brain disease. We think of it as a brain disease at heart. There are GI issues like constipation. There can be challenging emotions, anxiety, depression, you know, you name it. There can be skin issues, actually, like things we don't always think about. Which kind of means, and then the other thing is like, while it would be really fair if a diagnosis of Parkinson's made you immune from other issues that come up, it doesn't. So sometimes I take care of people where Parkinson's is like not their biggest issue, honestly. And so sometimes like I need help managing a Parkinson's symptom. Like if someone has like serious, you know, GI movement problems, like I might ask for help from a gastroenterologist because like I can't do the test that evaluates for that. And then sometimes I might need help, like, is there something else going on here? I don't want to miss like a new non-Parkinson's related GI specialist. So it takes a lot of nuance and communication. Like I need to be able to tell them, I don't think this is a purely Parkinson's related GI issue, and here's why. And they might need to be able to tell me like why they do or do not see a separate GI issue.
Right. So that is that's a nice sort of groundwork for the conversation we're going to have. I think I just want to draw attention to the fact that we're going to look at this question of how do we know when to see which person and how do we orchestrate that care? I think that's one of the primary things we want to talk about.
I could certainly speak to that, but also happy to like let some of the other panelists chime in with their like lived experience.
All right. Go ahead, Jen.
Sure. So I think like I always tell my patients, the people I'm taking care of, like it's complicated. And a lot of other doctors, when they hear Parkinson's disease, honestly will tell you to see your neurologist. So I have sort of just accepted that a big, you know, and sort of embraced that a big part of my role is sometimes just helping to decide like, is this Parkinson's disease or not? And I'm totally fine sort of trying to triage and like think about what's in the differential. If, you know, I keep coming back to GI stuff as I feel like it comes up all the time, like one is this Parkinson's related constipation that's very common, I feel comfortable treating it, versus like when is there something that red flags to me that this is not typical? Like, I don't, making this up a little, not making it up, but I'm just spitballing here, but like if something was really like abrupt in onset, like that would make me very, like that's kind of weird. That would make me very concerned that there's something else. Like, is there something obstructing someone's GI tract or something? So I really don't mind being sort of like a, trying to be an interpreter and trying to help get give people advice about where they might want to go. If I think that something is not Parkinson's related and out of my wheelhouse, where I might not be the right doctor for that issue. And I give, you know, I'm happy to facilitate referrals and place them myself.
So I would say one thing. Go ahead, Melina.
Well, I was just going to say, one of the things that was true for me when I was caring for my husband was that we just simply didn't know about all those non-motor symptoms and that they might be connected. And I've become wiser over the years, and now I lead a support group for caregivers. And that question comes up a lot that when they talk about a symptom that they've got that, you know, they don't understand, what should I do? And I almost always tell them at least check with the neurologist first and let them figure out whether it's related or not. And if so, do they need to coordinate?
Yeah, very closely connected to what I was about to say, which is that I think it's important to note that you may have a primary person providing your Parkinson's care who doesn't take the approach that Jen takes and who doesn't respond very well if you reach out to them. And I would just encourage you to think, if that's the case, this is so hard to say, I hate to even say it, but it might be worth thinking about whether you're seeing the right person, because so many questions need to be, it's hard to know what's Parkinson's and what's not sometimes. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's not. And if your primary Parkinson's provider is not helping you with that question, it can be even more challenging. And we don't need more challenge when we're living with Parkinson's, at least not from my perspective. I'd rather have less challenge.
One of the things that I run into is that often other people in my care team, at least initially, other practitioners within my care team really didn't have a background in Parkinson's. And so it almost turned into an opportunity for me to educate my other care team practitioners about what Parkinson's means. I remember going into my dermatologist for my annual check, and I said, well, you know, I've got Parkinson's. And she said, oh, that's interesting. And I said, no, it's more than interesting. And I pulled out some information, which I'm sure was very annoying. But I said, there is a link between Parkinson's and melanoma, and you need to be aware of that because you're treating me as a Parkinson's patient.
Yeah, so that's an important thing too, that you can do that work. If you are not comfortable as a person with Parkinson's taking that step, first of all, it might help to pursue some study and some work with self-efficacy, because that's part of that. We'll talk about that a little later, I think. But also, if you don't feel comfortable doing that, it's worthwhile to think about asking for somebody in your care team to help with that. And you know, don't feel like you have to take the burden on yourself, although it might be the easiest way if you are comfortable with it. So that's a nice way to phase into the next point of sort of the challenges of building a care team and finding access to care, which is, if you live in a relatively urban area, or if you have care providers near you, which I think thankfully many of the people in the live audience today do, you may not have that much of a challenge in finding care that you need, whether it's with a gastroenterologist or some other provider. But if you are in a rural area, a more remote area with fewer practitioners, maybe that's not as easy. So maybe, Adrian and Wendy, maybe you might have something to say about how your experience in that, in those more challenging environments with sort of a lower density of care.
Okay. I'm more recently moved into a rural area here, but I'm seeing what people are going through. Few providers. The closest provider from me is 30 miles away, period. There's no nurse practitioners or physicians closer. There is a neurologist 30 miles away, a general neurologist, to find movement disorder. I was looking for that, and I think it's Seattle is the closest one to me. But in general, finding a neuro specialist, the movement disorder provider, will be a travel. And so you will people in rural areas will not see them as their regular neurologist. They will most likely be working with a general neurologist closer, and then maybe twice a year travel further to see a movement disorder specialist. It's just the way it is with all specialists here. We do drive 2.5 hours to see specialists. My thoughts on that I found out is that if you're going to see a specialist, like a movement disorder specialist, and it's that far away and you're going to do it about twice a year, pick fall and spring for your twice a year, not summer and winter, if you're in a cold, snowy environment, so that you don't have to worry about traveling in the winter. The other thing, I was very impressed recently by trying to schedule a specialist 2.5 hours away, that when they called me to schedule, the first thing the scheduler said was, how far is your drive? How long does it take to get here? And I thought that was just so excellent. It's the first time somebody ever asked that, and it was the first thing she asked. So I really appreciated what she said. And if when making these distant appointments, to advocate for yourself that no, I really can't make an 8 o'clock appointment. It really does have to be middle of the day because I have to drive so far. And for any providers that may be listening, yeah, to talk with your schedulers and see if they can keep midday appointments for those who have to travel, particularly if you're in a city that has a lot of rural people that come into it, like would be Anchorage. I can't say how much I appreciated that.
Yeah, it certainly suggests a sensitivity on the part of the practitioner to your situation. Mm-hmm. And of course, here in Alaska, while we have quite a great deal of our population, about half of our population is centered in Anchorage, we have a huge landmass with people all over the place. And there is a lot of traveling, usually including flying, to get anywhere to a specialist. And so all the things that you were saying, Wendy, earlier really resonated with me about that. You know, the other thing is that with the COVID situation, telemed came online, and you know, there's pros and cons to telemed, but one of the things I find is that, especially for folks that are in rural situations, it's a godsend. Because they are able to get information specifically for their situation that can help them. And along with telemed, of course, there's different kinds of things on the internet, like this, webinars and such, that can be very, very useful to answer questions. The thing there is that you have to have a certain amount of discernment when you choose your sources. So those would be the things that I would add.
Yeah. All right. I want to add one other little note here, which is that, you know, Wendy, you mentioned that the closest movement disorder specialist may be Seattle, but I just want to draw attention to, you can be a little creative about this too and think, well, maybe I don't need to go to Seattle to the nearest one. Maybe I have a family member I want to visit in Texas, and I know I'm going to Texas once or twice a year, and make that appointment with somebody in Texas because you're going there anyway. You know, just to think outside of the box a little bit can be helpful in accessing care when you're in a rural environment or a more remote place.
I've been listening to this, and really, if I close my eyes, you could be talking about Canada, because some of those challenges are exactly the same in terms of access to care, the travel, there's a cost. You know, I saw my neurologist once for half an hour and then twice a year, and that's it. So it's, you know, it's a challenge in terms of what we're talking about. But I'd like to just go one step higher. You know, it's a challenge in the healthcare industry and in a healthcare delivery model that supports acute care and not chronic care. And I think that's an you know, we live with a chronic illness, and we need to have the team around us. And it was interesting. The poll I saw said that in the US, you have most of people with Parkinson's see a specialist, whereas in Canada, 77% only see a general physician. So there's the issue of, you know, delayed diagnosis and missed Parkinson's symptoms diagnosis. So very similar challenges. And hopefully we can get to talk about some of the solutions as well.
Yeah, I think we're nearing that point where we'll start to talk about some of the ways that we can work around some of these issues. I want to draw attention to the fact that someone in the chat just mentioned that this sounds fairly specific to the U.S. And I think it's true that largely we are talking about things in the context of the U.S. healthcare system, although, as Larry just said, it's relevant in Canada as well. Before we jump into solutions, I just want to ask Milena if there's any particular challenges that you think the care partners have in this regard. I mean, obviously, one thing is that care partners have to help the person that they're caring for, their person with Parkinson's, and they also have to take care of their own care. So do you have any insight into that circumstance, Milena?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we have to recognize is that this may be a person's first experience with a progressive disease. And if that's the case, then we're kind of used to the usual model where if it's you're taking your husband to the clinic or whatever, you know, it's mainly for them. And so we kind of hold back when we go to the doctor's office if it's a neurologist and just sit there and think, well, okay, I'll take care of my husband and, you know, make sure his needs are met. And patients do that too. Sometimes they will hold back in terms of what they're willing to admit to their doctor, right? So I think being honest and in communicating is important, but that requires that you have some knowledge about it too. So, you know, you have to have knowledge about what things you need to bring up, like it's already been talked about, and then you have to feel empowered to bring that up and mention it to people when you're worried about it. And even if we have a need to share our concerns, we may not do so because there are things that we don't want our partner to hear. So, and that works both ways too. Sometimes the patient won't want to say anything during an appointment. I know sometimes that can be solved by separating the two during an appointment. That's not always feasible, I know, in a clinic, but there needs to be ways to communicate those things without being in front of each other if that's an issue. And then the other thing is just as the disease progresses, it gets more and more difficult to care. You go from being kind of the couple that you always were to being to a point where the caregivers doing almost everything, and it's quite overwhelming. So you may find yourself reluctant to try to take on a lot of different appointments, especially if distance is a problem. And you're basically living day by day, so your energy level is kind of low, and you may not even have time to analyze the kinds of things that you need. And another thing that I think kind of plays into this is isolation. Your community sinks. It happens as you go on, right? So there are fewer opportunities for your friends, family, whoever, to notice what's going on with you. And, you know, maybe they see things in you that you don't. They're willing to talk about that if you've still got those connections. So it just becomes harder to identify your needs and your expectations. And when that's a blur, we can't determine the kind of help we need. So it's important to have people that can walk us through that. And I think, you know, working with a clinic that's willing to do that is huge.
Yeah. So I, when you were speaking, I thought of two things. And the first thing is that, you know, I think One way to address the need to sort of balance all the sort of competing pressures is to approach the appointments as a team when you go in with your person with Parkinson's and with your care partner, and to sort of distribute the labor a little bit potentially. And that might include using tools like a translator or a recording device if you get clearance with your provider to record the interview or the conversation that you're having with any provider, so that you don't have to worry about taking notes and you can instead focus on making sure the questions you ask are answered. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that, you know, with regard to getting people, you know, getting your concerns as the care partner heard, I wonder if maybe Wendy has a perspective about the utility that the RN staff might be able to have in this regard.
Certainly. And of course, every clinic's different, and the how RNs are used will be different in each clinic, but I think for a lot of them, the RN is available to see you during the visit or at the end of the visit. And I think for advocating for yourself at the end of a visit, particularly if you only had a 15-minute visit with your neurologist and didn't get all your questions answered, to say at the end, hey, can I review this? You know, your instructions for me, the after visit summary, whatever it's called, wherever you are, with the nurse, so that I'm sure that I know what we discussed here, and just after at the end of the visit. And then when the nurse comes in, you can also ask any questions that didn't get answered. The other thing that can be done is to make a phone call to the nurse, you know, a week later. The problem with that is that you're going to play phone tag and it's not face to face. So I think that doing it at the appointment is the preferable way to do it, if you can, and if the person's available to see you and answer those questions.
I think that's a great point made, that, you know, you're putting the caregiver or the person with Parkinson's at the center of care. And that could be a timing issue, because in my lived experience, I had that initial appointment and then I went into a complete depression for nearly 2 years. And it's only when I accepted Parkinson's that I started living again. So, you know, those meetings that we have with our neurologist is sort of a sliding scale. It depends where we are on the journey to have more information or less information. And I remember the early days in the neurologist, I was trying to convince the neurologist that I had conquered this and that I, you know, had overcome this adversity. And only obviously years gone by that I changed my perspective. But what I think is crucial is being at the center of care, being the advocate for your own care, but when that comes is a timeline that only can be dependent and determined by the person with Parkinson's at that date of acceptance.
I think that is extremely true, Larry. And along with that, when you mentioned isolation, I think that really gives us a point of entry into the support groups. Very often what will happen is that, and I don't know if this is anybody else's experience, but I knew nothing about Parkinson's until the absolute day that I was diagnosed with it. And it, I like to say that I walked out of the office and my head exploded. And the thing that helped me the most was the group of people that I met at Rocksteady Boxing. It could be, you know, another type of form of group, but the group of people that were living with it that I could say, you know, along with what I was doing in my research, what is going on with you? I know we're not supposed to compare to one another, but to just have a group of like-minded people to be able to give me the kinds of support that I needed early on with my journey.
Yeah, it took me 5 years to get to a support group, and I wish I would have had the time again, because I felt comfortable sitting down at that meeting the first time. And before then, I was trying to do all the research myself and didn't know what I was doing. So, you know, support groups are great.
Yeah, so yeah, one thing that's great about a support group is that you can hear from people in your area as to how they're solving their care access needs. But you know, you still need to make sure you're, and they can also give you tips on how to plan for your appointments. But I wonder if maybe that's one thing that we can sort of transition into talking about some solutions to these issues. And I wonder if maybe, Jen, you can talk a little bit about how we can prepare better for our appointments, and how we can, there's a question in the chat that I want to draw specific attention to, which is, how can we make sure that our providers are communicating together if we're seeing multiple subspecialists or something to that effect? So can you just offer some insight into that, please, Jen?
I think that, like, unfortunately, like, I've been looking at some of the chat comments. I think, like, sort of the theme, one way I would summarize some of the comments about, like, wait times and short appointments is, like, time is our most precious commodity. And to be honest, the shortage of physicians is not getting better tomorrow. And we have to split our time between new patients and follow-ups. And it's just, right, more time for longer follow-up visits would mean longer new patient wait time visits. And I don't have a great answer for that. So efficiency kind of becomes the name of the game, if that's possible. I realize that Parkinson's can cause speech and cognitive changes that don't always make that super feasible. But when people are able, coming with your list of things to talk about, and that can include, like alluding to an earlier conversation, that can include, I have a symptom, I want to run it by you if this is Parkinson's or not, is a helpful thing. If you just say, here's a 30-minute, you know, follow-up visit for someone with Parkinson's, there's like 600 questions I could ask, because there's so many things that can come with Parkinson's. So, like, if you can help, and there's probably things I will, if I'm prescribing medication, I do feel a little obligated to at least ask you if you have side effects, just because that feels like a responsible thing for me to do if I'm prescribing something. But otherwise, like, just help me know, like, what's on your mind today and what's bothering you. That can entail a little bit of research. Our Movement Disorder Center has a pretty extensive review of symptoms form for follow-up visits, which I think can be helpful in just helping people know, like, you're probably not having all of them, so almost no one ever does, but, you know, what is in, like, the spectrum of things we could talk about and address. But I think, like, coming with your list, if you're not already doing that, is helpful. If you really want time away from a care partner, or if a care, or vice versa, a care partner wants to talk to us alone, there's a way you can say that at the front desk or send a patient portal message. Sometimes, like, people have done that, like, I'm concerned about my loved one driving. Here's my, you know, sort of behind the scenes message to you that we need to talk about this sticky issue, or might have to separate people. That's very helpful. In terms of communication, there is no national health record system, and that makes this very difficult. It is very easy for me to communicate with people within my medical system that I work in, which is expanding all the time and could be an upside to health systems sort of consolidating. But if someone is, I take care of a lot of people in rural New York where I might be the only university doctor they see, let me know if there's someone specific that my note needs to go back to, because that doesn't automatically happen. We will have to, you know, hunt down like the fax number potentially for an office, like, and that's just not an automatic function. If there's someone that you, if you're, say, struggling with, you know, people can have blood pressure drops from Parkinson's disease, and cardiac, some heart medications can make that worse. So if you see, like, you know, a cardiologist I don't necessarily know about for blood pressure issues or heart rhythm issues, like, let me know and I will get my note to them. And I may also document differently. Like, if I'm following up on something and I'm going to see you in 2 months, I just need the note to reflect what happened today, so I remember what happened the next time we see you. But I'm also happy to write a more educational note to an outside specialist, like saying, I anticipate that as Parkinson's progresses, we'll need to dial back blood pressure medications to avoid dangerous low blood pressure, blah, blah, blah. Like, I'm happy to write that. I just need to know that that specialist exists and who they are, so we can figure out, like, how to get the note to them. I hope that helps.
Yeah, so you just said two important things, I think. The first, well, more than that, but two that I want to draw specific attention to, which are that we might come with a huge list of concerns to our appointments, and that's going to be hard to avoid. But it might be important to triage that list yourself as the person going to the appointment, to say, so you can go into the appointment and say, this is what I really need to make sure we talk about today. These two things, these three things. And then if you can get the rest of them addressed, that's great. But I think making sure you're coming in with a list that is actually organized so you can get the things addressed is important. And that list should probably include what Jen just said, which is what provider needs to receive notification about the outcomes of this visit, and who needs to be corresponded with. I know I have never done that. And that's a great tip that I should really be doing.
One of the things that I do at every appointment that I go to with my specialist is I have three things in my hand. I have my current list of the top five things that I want to talk about. I have my current list of medications, including the amounts that I'm taking and the times. And then I have my current list of my care team, and I have names, I have clinics, I have addresses, I have fax numbers, phone numbers, and every time I walk into that office, I have those three pieces of paper that I update every time before I go into a meeting.
Yeah, that's great. The medication thing is actually especially important because sometimes that can slip. If you don't think about it, you might not remember. I know I've had some medications that I was taking, I forgot to mention them, and that's not a good outcome. Doesn't help get good outcomes. So I wanted to draw attention to something else that was in the chat, which is regarding very long wait times. There is an organization called Synapticure, which is providing remote neurological care. I don't know if Jen, you have any awareness of how that works or not, but I know they're national and in the US, and I don't know if they're seeing any international folks, but related to that also, I know there's some states do have agreements where you can see providers in different on via telemedicine on from different states, and some do not. So that's another way to potentially think about ways to decrease the wait times. Another thing that... go ahead. Sorry.
I met a woman from Synapticure last year at a conference, and you know, I got a little bit of information from her, and I thought it was fascinating. They have movement disorder people that are licensed in all 50 states. So you'll get somebody no matter where you live. And they say it only takes 2 weeks to get an appointment. I don't know if that's still true or not, but that's pretty good. And in terms of other resources, like if you need a social worker or things like that, then they'll try to connect you with people in your own community. So it's a great idea. And I don't know of anybody else that's doing it, but maybe it's a good idea for somebody else to think about.
So one other thing I wanted to draw attention to that I think some folks on this panel have some awareness of is the way that a clinical trial, participating in a clinical trial, even an observational trial, might be a way to get yourself more frequent connection with expert providers.
Yeah, I can talk about the COPE PD study that's ongoing right now. And the purpose of the study is to train general neurologists in the community how to implement palliative care in their practice. And the way it's working is that there are neurologists around the country that have signed up for this, and then their patients that want to be included in part of that are also given, you know, the extra things that they needed. Anything that they need in terms of social work, chaplains, and that kind of stuff is taken care of by the study itself. So that's kind of an automatic thing, and that's worked out really well, I think. I think it's huge that the concept of palliative care has grown so much over the last 10 years. You know, it started out with just very few. I think I went to the first one in the United States when my husband and I moved to Colorado. Since then, all the Parkinson's Foundation Centers of Excellence have included the palliative care. And now we're reaching out to local communities to spread it even further. So that's a great way. If you are interested in the trial, you can look on the website, and you can answer some questions and see if you're eligible to participate.
Yeah, and I think Everett is going to put the link to that, the COPE PD trial, in the chat. There's also the PERSEVERE study, which is being run by Jory Fleischer, which might be relevant to some folks about improving their access to care. That's a pretty big study as well. Anything else on trials? Anybody have any other insights about that?
I'm part of the COPE PD study. I'm the nurse. There's two nurses. I'm the one that has most of the time for talking to the patients and their care partners for the COPE PD study. It's done via Zoom or telephone calls, if Zoom's difficult for some people. As the nurse, I call about every 3 months while they're in the study. And so they get access to nurses' conversation with them also. It's one of the studies that's out there that can be helpful. And yes, I've seen other studies where people can, depending on what they're studying, you can learn a lot and get more care on that subject. Like maybe it would be fatigue. I know that University of Colorado had done a study on fatigue, and you know, so that part of the study you can get extra care on or get extra information on that part of what you're dealing with.
So, you know, a lot of the ways that we've talked about tips for sort of navigating this landscape of access to care relates to people taking initiative. So I wonder if, Adrian, you can comment a little bit about self-efficacy, and if anybody else wants to chime in as far as tips for how to just advocate for yourself and give yourself the best chance to succeed in your care journey with Parkinson's. I'd love to hear that as we sort of round out the conversation. So Adrian, can you give some sense of what self-efficacy means to you and how that can be important?
You bet. I think self-efficacy is the most important thing for folks with PD to embrace as a way of feeling that you still have control over your life. Self-efficacy is about acknowledging that you can affect the outcomes of experiences by what you do and say. And one of the things, as I was preparing for this webinar, one of the things is that I realized is that self-efficacy really starts with self-awareness. Being a person on the Parkinson's journey, you know, not in a hypochondriac way, but you need to be aware of what is going on in your body, in your mood, in your social relationships. You need to be more attentive to yourself than you may have been in the past. And the other thing about that is for you to, in some way, keep a record of that to help you develop your list when you go to the doctor. So, you know, if you're getting ready to go to an appointment and it's, you know, a week away, the things that are on the top of your mind may not be the most important issues that you need to be dealing with. But if you're keeping some sort of a journal or a record of what's going on, you can look over since the last appointment and say, oh yeah, okay, well, you know, the constipation is the issue that I really need to put to the forefront. The other thing about self-efficacy is that it's an ownership issue. And Larry, when you talked about early on that you had at the beginning some issues of you know, you were going to conquer this disease, and you that was kind of the feeling. There's an importance in accepting Parkinson's, accepting your diagnosis. And you really are at a standstill until you accept your diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And once you accept your diagnosis, then you can step the first step to your journey that will allow you to live the very best life that you can. The other thing that for me, when I was early in my diagnosis, is that the Davis-Finney Every Victory Counts series was incredibly helpful for me. And the most recent set of those documents that has been produced, and it's online as well, I understand, really helped me to step through a lot of my concerns and fears, and to help me establish a way of looking at my life and my disease and my choices to the best of my ability.
Yeah, setting us up for success. I mean, I have a dream that you walk out of the neurologist's office with the prescription for your medication and a copy of the Every Victory Counts manual in both hands, because then you set up for success. And I think that's the biggest dilemma. That first 90 days is make or break.
And a phone number for your local support group.
Right.
Yeah.
So I want to draw attention to one little nuance here, which is that the 90 days when you're diagnosed are important, but at a certain point, things change. You get to mid-stage Parkinson's and then you're like, whoa, all of a sudden my doses are wearing off. And then that's another 90 days right there. That's a new game. Yeah. That's not a nice thing to say about it. It's not really a game. It's not a game I want to play. But, you know, once that starts to happen, it changes and you might need to reevaluate that, those 90 days critically in that moment. And that's a time to get your communication in order with your primary Parkinson's provider. Send them a note through the portal. Call the office if you don't have that access to the portal. And, you know, speak to an RN. Speak to the medical assistant if that's the only person you can get in touch with directly. But take some initiative when there's changes, because that's the only way you're going to access the care that's helpful from a provider. As we close this meeting, because we're at the hour mark here, I just want to draw attention to something that was alluded to earlier. But the Davis-Finney Ambassador Program is another great way to reach people who can help you find the best provider for your local needs. And we have ambassadors across the US and in I think we're at 11 countries now, but I think Everett is going to put some links in the chat. And you know, we have ambassadors who know the situation in their basic vicinity, and they can help you find the care you need from the providers you need by giving you local recommendations as to who's the knowledgeable provider in the area about topic A, B, or C. I guess we'll close up now, and I just want to thank everybody for being here. Thank you to this panel. It was great to get the opportunity to connect with you, and thanks for sharing your thoughts and expertise, and thanks to everybody for joining us.